the Senate Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy. We're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 161. And although we're not going to move the bill today, we will talk about the amendments that we don't have yet. So, Dr. Higginson, would you come up, please? And Deborah Whiting, would you also come up, please?
I'm assuming it's Katie King's fault. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I didn't want to say that. Okay, would you, Dr. Higginson, would you?
Yes, Chair Morissette and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I am here today to, again, support Senate Bill 151, go through some of the amendments that we are discussing, and this is important to us because one of the programs in my office is healthcare licensing and certification, and as you know from the last time we discussed, at the request of the Department of Justice, this bill would move the hospice regulatory authority from a certification program by outside agencies to a licensing program that would be under healthcare licensing and certification. You, I believe, have seen the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments, and in discussing those amendments with our partners in the hospice industry, they did some of the things that we wanted but didn't quite accomplish all of them. So a Dash 3 amendments will be coming. Those Dash 3 amendments will cover everything that we want covered in the amendments. So the ones and twos will not need to be adopted. All that you would need to adopt would be the Dash 3s. And basically what it does is clarify a few things, primarily around the certification piece. So that what we are saying is to become licensed, you could either have the state program come out and do a survey once every 3 years, or you could rely on an accrediting program to come do that, and we would then be invited to the exit interview. It specifies in the amendments exactly what kind of those agencies, accredited agencies, would be and what kind of standards they would have to meet. Another thing we needed to do, we agreed to do, was to put the fees in statute rather than have them be in rule, and so that has been added, and the change needed to be made to the summary statement as well. And then there is a little change in language talking about where the monies would be placed within the state's budget, and that language is very similar to the language that we did for the in-home care agencies last legislative session. So those are what the Dash 3 amendments are going to do, and I hope I didn't miss anything and would be happy to answer any questions. But we believe that with the Dash 3s, we are happy with them, and the hospice industry is happy with them as well. Okay. Thanks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. Will the Dash 3s change the fiscal analysis any? Because when I'm looking at it in 11-13, the revenues, and I'm assuming that's the fees, does not cover the expenditures.
Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, the fiscal impact, my understanding, is the same for the Dash 3s is what you're seeing in front of you right now. And my understanding is that the revenues don't match because of because we would not be starting the program. We aren't going to be getting all the fees in for that first year, but over time those will match, and I'd have to spend time looking at that to be able to explain exactly how that works.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just follow up. That's fine, Grant. I mean, it's the initial phases. I was just looking at the differential for the next biennium and thinking if that differential was a true differential, then you have a problem over time.
And Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, I don't have that in front of me. I'm sorry. So I will be happy to go over that with you another time.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Telford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go backwards a little bit. Currently, actually, this is going to cost $750 to be a fee to be paid in these times of economic challenges. We're actually taking on another program at the state level where we already have that program being done by somebody else who's paying all the expenses and everything else. So explain to me again, excuse me, why we're doing this, where exactly is the constitutional challenge exposure?
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, and You should have in your materials a letter from the Department of Justice trying to explain their concerns. But my understanding is that the state cannot give authority, regulatory authority, to an agent that is outside of state government. And that is, in essence, the way the law read before, because it was giving some kind of certification authority to these outside agencies, but there was no licensing authority by the state. And so our understanding was that we needed to have licensing authority and by a state entity, and that we could still accept the work that was done by accrediting bodies, but the authority for licensing needed to be a state one. That is my understanding.
Yes.
Well, one of them is the federal government, and so I'm just wondering why we shouldn't let the federal government, the federal centers for Medicare and Medicaid, continue to foot the bill on this versus us taking it in-house, charging all the hospice centers $750, like I say, at a time when we've got some economic challenges, and let somebody else foot the bill.
And Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, we've been asked to do this by the Department of Justice, and we are following through on that request.
Chair,
yes.
I find it interesting because we're dealing with lawyers here, and, you know, for things to be, I mean, the bar is outside of state jurisdiction, and they license lawyers. And, you know, so for lawyers to be saying nobody else can have that sort of status, I find interesting.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, the reason I see value in this is I actually did home health. And I wasn't hospice, but I was in the home. And there are some egregious things that are happening to our most vulnerable and the elderly in the home. And when an agency doesn't have the jurisdiction to sanction a provider or an organization because they are not following through, it's much easier to have the state being able to sanction, basically, those groups that are performing services to a very vulnerable group. And we have had two members, who gave stories last session regarding the experiences they had with an in-home I'm not sure if it was hospice or if it was, anyway. And so that's why I feel it's one thing for someone back in the East Coast or wherever to review charts and say, yes, they're doing okay. But it's another thing to be actually go into the home and see, or the facility and see what's going on. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Verger.
Yes, I'd like to just follow up a little bit on a couple of the comments. One, I believe that the description of the one testimony that we heard was that they had sent a home care worker out that could probably feed the cat and water the plants, and sent him into a very vulnerable situation. And so I think that was one of them. I guess my question is, since you do license or would be licensing the hospice program in each one of these locations, do you also have oversight? Because to me, it's the oversight part that's so missing in this.
Chair Morrisite and Senator Verger, yes, we would have oversight. And when I say we do the licensing, what that entails is a on-site inspection once every 3 years, or, like I said, the acceptance of an accreditation on-site inspection where we participate in the exit interview. And it also, as Senator Mona Anderson correctly points out, it allows us to aggressively follow up any complaints. And so that's really the program, once every 3 years inspection, aggressive follow-up of complaint by state staff who would go out and do that as part of the licensing responsibility that we have.
Okay. Which state staff would do that? Go ahead.
Yeah, Chair Morissette, we would hire somebody or actually build on to a position that already exists in the healthcare licensing and certification program within my office.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you. So we should have the dash threes soon.
Yeah, we requested them by today and unfortunately didn't receive them.
So we'll carry this over.
Yeah, and then we'll schedule it for a work session.
Deborah, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Morissette, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. I'm Deborah Whiting Jakes. I'm the Executive Director and CEO of the Oregon Hospice Association. The Oregon Hospice Association, as Dr. Higginson has mentioned, has been a partner with the state and with the Oregon Association for Home Care to ensure that terminally ill Oregonians have access to and receive high-quality end-of-life care. For the past 30 years, the OHA has been involved in this effort. For the last 18 years, the Oregon Hospice Association and the Department of Human Services have been in a public and private partnership when the Oregon Hospice Statutes were first implemented in 1981. The Oregon Hospice Association does support state licensure for hospice programs. We have not in the past, nor do we now, oppose state licensure. We believe that oversight is important for Oregon's terminally ill. As Senator Moniz Anderson points out, this is a fragile group of individuals who benefit from having programs, both private and public, to ensure that the care is appropriate and professional, to your point, Senator Verger, about individuals being licensed to provide the kind of professional care that is needed at the end of life. Since we met here last time with Senator Betsy Johnson, who encouraged the department and the Oregon Hospice Association to work together to come up with a revised statute that meets the needs of both the public and the private sector, Dr. Higginson, his staff, and I have been in active discussions. The OHA believes that the amendment, the Dash 3 amendment, does serve the interests of the terminally ill in the state of Oregon, and we are confident that when we see the Dash 3 amendment, that those provisions will meet the requirements that the OHA has established. Again, our intent and our sole purpose is to ensure that there's high-quality end-of-life care for Oregonians. And I would be delighted to answer any questions you might have of me.
Questions? The last session, we had a bill to allow a hospice in Lane County that was formerly associated with, I believe, McKinsey Willamette to locate on forest agricultural land. It would have required a change in the land use laws, but that didn't happen, and so the concern was lack of hospice services in Lane County. Is there a problem with hospice services in Lane County or anywhere else in the state as far as...
Thank you, Senator Morissette. There is not a problem with access to end-of-life care in Lane County. I recently met with two hospices in Eugene who provide care in Lane County. Both have a significant census in their agencies. Both are affiliated with McKenzie Willamette, as you mentioned, loosely now. I understand they have gone through another management change at McKenzie Willamette, and the Sacred Heart Group. There also are private hospices in Lane County that serve individuals who have need of end-of-life care. So there is not an issue in Lane County. Over this past year, we have seen one hospice in the eastern reaches of our state lose their Medicare certification. They were providing what would be seen as home health service rather than hospice services, and there is a difference. So that program agreed, and they have decided that at this point they do not have certification to be a hospice. We are working with them to encourage them to, again, go through the process and become certified, and if this bill goes through, licensed to be a hospice in the state of Oregon. Today, other programs that are... I hesitate to say in the neighborhood because it's over 100 miles away, would provide care to those patients should they need it. Patients do have access to home health services in that area.
Mr.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Bridger.
Thank you. You have another problem or a potential problem other than just the way that the service is rendered to people. People who are in the last stages of their life are very vulnerable to kindness, and they also can will their estate, particularly if there are not many family members. And so I think it would be very wise to take a look at the kind of beneficiary that some hospice associations have been from the people that they have taken care of.
Thank you, Senator Verger. Senator Morissette, I agree that the population that we serve is vulnerable. What you are talking about is unethical behavior, and hospice programs and the Oregon Hospice Association would find this to be contradictory to ethical practices.
Thanks. I'm sure.
So it is true, as you point out, that individuals do, as a result of their experience with hospice, sometimes leave memorials to the local hospice that has provided care to them. However, in the state of Oregon, it is the amount of donations most frequently is in the level of about 5% of a hospice's income. So while it's not de minimis, it certainly is not a significant contribution to what hospices receive for the care that they provide. Primarily, the compensation comes from Medicare. About 85% of the revenue that hospices receives comes from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid through the hospice Medicare benefit.
A follow-up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. So that would not include residences, possessions of whatever is in the residence, possessions of jewelry. I mean, expensive items, I think, would be what I was thinking.
I see. Senator Morissette, Senator Verger, it is contrary to policy for hospices. It is contrary to practice and ethical considerations from the OHA's perspective for individuals who are hospice workers to accept gifts of any value from patients and family members. It is not allowed.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for that clarification, because I was going to follow up with a question about that, but that does not mean that a person could leave something in their will?
An individual could, through their counsel, leave either funds or objects in their personal possessions in their will to the hospice who provided care to them. Yes, that is true.
Okay.
If there are concerns that are raised by neighbors, family members, others, who I believe, Senator Verger, you had made a comment at the last hearing about a personal experience that you had become aware of. The SPD departments, Seniors and Disabilities, the Department for Seniors and Disabilities, the local district attorney's offices, there are means to handle issues that are inappropriate and even illegal that exist beyond the scope of the Oregon Hospice Association, and I expect are beyond the scope of what DHS would see in their oversight as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Grant. Okay. Now we won't have a fiscal on dash threes or there is a revenue. I believe I didn't see it.
We won't have those on the dash three until we actually get the amendment.
Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 161, and we will open an informational hearing on the 211. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just for your information, Senator Telfer said that they just installed the 211. Is that correct?
Started one in Bend. Deschutes County in
yes.
Bend, yeah.
Okay. Good. Would you introduce yourself, please?
We will. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Stephen Guntley, and my colleague is Jerry Shumate, and we'll tell you a little bit more about our organizations in a moment, but I wanted to thank Senator Bill Morissette for inviting us to give a presentation on the status of 211 in Oregon to the senators on the Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee. First of all, I wanted to apologize because we did manage to incorrectly name your committee on the first slide that you have, but we did correct it on this slide. So our apologies for that confusion. And I want you to feel free to interrupt us with questions as we do our presentation. I think we have time for that. So if you feel you have a question as we go along, that's fine. And as I said, my name is Stephen Guntley, and I'm the interim executive director of Oregon 211. And I had been on the board of directors of this nonprofit agency for several years as a representative from the Oregon Child Care Resource and Referral Network. I stayed involved after I left OCCRRN because I felt 211 was a critical resource for Oregon, both for health and human service support and as a critical tool during an emergency. I was board chair of Oregon 211 for a year and a half before I took over as executive director last September. Our goal is to establish 211 service in every county in Oregon. Oregon 211 is working closely with 211 Info to accomplish that goal. In fact, we are in the process of integrating Oregon 211 and 211 Info into one organization. This is for the sake of efficiency, but our mission remains to bring 211 service to all of Oregon. I would like to give Jerry a chance to introduce herself as well.
Thank you, Senator Morissette, and members of this committee. My name is Jerry Shumate, and I've been the executive director of 211 Info since it started in 2004. We've distributed copies of our PowerPoint slide presentation for you to make notes on, and we've also given you a two-page document that we put together last summer to support the submission of a $4.5 million policy option package that the Oregon Office of Emergency Management submitted to the governor's office last fall on our behalf. The budget page outlines three options for the funding of 211 that would help us move forward. There's also a one-page summary of 211 in Oregon, and a report on calls received during 2008 by our call center in Portland, which is currently the only call center in the state. We will be referring to those handouts as we go through our presentation. 211 is critically important to our health and human services community, especially during our current economic crisis, when information on housing, job training, food, and shelter have become critical. But callers' needs include family and children's services, financial assistance, help with utility needs, health care, mental health, and government programs. With proper funding, we also have the ability to provide special support and help for a wide range of vulnerable populations. And we will touch on this in a moment, but 211 is also critically important to the public safety community, having been embraced nationally by police, fire, and 911 personnel as a vital new tool that supports their efforts both during normal times and especially during a disaster or crisis. So what is 211? 211 is to social services what 911 is to emergency services. It's a single, easy-to-remember telephone number that helps people find and give help. With almost 14,000 nonprofit organizations in Oregon, plus scores of government agencies, many of them with 800 numbers to be remembered, finding help can be very confusing and intimidating. Many folks who need help give up before they even find that help they need. 211 offers a trained specialist who quickly assesses the caller's needs and then refers them to the help that can meet that need. 211 Info currently serves the Tri-County area of Portland in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. We have served Southwest Washington in Clark, Cowlitz, Wakayakum, and Skamania counties for 4 years, and we are now serving Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties with the phone service for their 211 system. That began on January 2nd. 211 has benefits over both existing information and referral hotlines and specialized 800 numbers. It creates a centralized response system and a centralized database of comprehensive information. It uses a real person to help callers find the help they need, and states that have implemented 211 statewide have experienced cost savings and efficiencies over their previous systems of information and referral support. As you can see, a statewide 211 system would be a tremendous asset to Oregon and the goals of the Senate Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee.
We'd just like to give you a little history on 211 now, since 211 is a national service. 211 has actually existed since 1997 and was officially designated for use as a specialized service in the year 2000. As Jerry told you, it was launched in Oregon in the Portland area in 2004, and Central Oregon initiated service at the beginning of the year. In 2005, Governor Kulongowski signed legislation encouraging the establishment of 211 in Oregon, set up an account in the state treasury to receive funds, and designated oversight of these funds to the Office of Emergency Management. Oregon 211 has worked closely with the staff at both the Department of Human Service and the Office of Emergency Management, and especially with Ken Murphy, head of OEM, to build the public-private partnership that would allow us to create statewide 211 service. Jeremy Emerson at DHS worked with us and Ken Murphy to put together the $4.5 million policy option package that OEM presented to the governor's office this fall. Although that never made it into the governor's budget, it was, we believe, an important step. I have been working on getting state legislators to come on board to support 211 in the future, and we've made some significant headway. We are also encouraged by the fact that the United Way of America has made the funding of 211 at the federal level their number one funding priority. We and 211 Info are now working closely to help move the Calling for 211 Act forward in the United States Senate and House. And 211 Info has approached Senator Wyden and Merkley for possible support through a federal earmark. We recently received a letter of support for these efforts from Dr. Bruce Goldberg, head of the Department of Human Services, and Victor Merced, head of Oregon Housing and Community Service.
Now, would you review or tell us about your current funding from the state of Oregon? Where are you getting your money?
One of the programs that is answered, one of the telephone lines that is answered at the 211 call center is a statewide helpline known as Oregon SafeNet. This is a helpline that is federally mandated. Every state is required to have a maternal child health helpline. Oregon SafeNet has been in existence for about 20 years. And when 211 began in the Portland area, the Oregon SafeNet helpline came over and worked with 211. So in that sense, the state has been supporting the development of 211 through Oregon SafeNet to the tune of around $275,000 per year, the majority of which is federal pass-through funds. Beyond that, there is no other state funding for 211 at this time. We are receiving funding from the United Way of Deschutes County, the United Way of the Columbia Willamette in the Portland area. We are receiving funding from some of the counties, some of the cities, and then other private foundations have put funds in to this point.
There is also some possibility, Chair Morissette, that we could receive stimulus money through an agency, for example, with food stamps, where some additional support could go to the people answering the phone and telling people about how to get food stamps. And that's something that DHS would be very interested in.
Inland County United Way is the umbrella group for 100% Access, which is a medical support group in Lane County. What about Lane County and 211?
Thank you. Lane County has been a strong partner in the development of the statewide system. In their region, they have put together a website that's known as 211lane.org. And so while they don't have the telephone service for 211 yet, they do have the web presence. We have been in conversation with the director of the United Way of Lane County. She is fully supportive of the efforts in front of us right now and the strategies for bringing 211 to the rest of the state.
So in Deschutes County and that group, is that supported by their United Way?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, thank you.
And the United Way of Columbia Willamette is very supportive of the service and really helped start the service in Portland. So the United Ways are very involved and have been involved across the country.
Okay. How about Coos, Curry, Douglas, that area?
The leadership in that community is coming from Umpqua Community Action Network primarily. I know that there's been some conversations with the United Way there, and I don't personally know whether United Way funds are involved at this point, but I know that they're apprised of development there.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Senator Brigham.
Are you capable at this point of doing reverse 211 in the Portland area where you're located?
Reverse 211 is not a resource available to us at this time. We would probably look to support a reverse 911 system. 2 years ago, when the wildfires hit San Diego, the reverse 911 system released a message saying, please evacuate. If you need more information, call 211. So that was the way that 211 was able to support that disaster setting.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Well, yes.
Actually, that's a pretty good thing, because then they do have a number to call, and besides relieving the 911 system of people calling, all people calling there, I guess that working through United Way statewide might be a really good thing. That's just kind of a comment. I like the partnership there. It sounds very good. Your 911 center hires Oregonians to answer phones?
Thank you. You mean our 211 center?
Uh-huh.
That is correct. Yes.
You do not outsource?
That is correct. Right. The most outsource we have is one employee who lives in Clark County, Washington.
Oh, okay.
Good.
Yes, Senator Ana Sanderson.
Suicide is really increasing, especially among our veteran population. And if someone calls in for help, are you able to get into the refer them? How is it set up for the 800 suicide hotline?
Thank you. Our staff are trained for crisis calls, although those are certainly a small handful a year of the 106,000 calls we had last year. And when that does happen, the staff member, the information referral specialist, assesses for the person's safety, may signal to other staff that they need some help with the call. There is the capacity for three-way conference calling or triaging by bringing in the 1-800-SUICIDE folks.
Thank you.
Several years ago, after the Thurston High School shootings, where four people were actually killed and many wounded, the Attorney General's office, Kevin Neely was an assistant Attorney General, and I was the mayor of Springfield at the time, and we worked on a call-in program, a phone program that we got some federal funds for a while, but it simply went away, and the purpose of that was to encourage students who knew or thought they knew that there was something about to happen could call that hotline. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. If somebody called that hotline and said, you know, I just heard some people talking about going into a school with a gun or a bomb or something, you would respond to that. But they wouldn't know about, is this hotline available for those kinds of emergencies?
211 is being used across the country for a number of initiatives that are locally relevant. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we've seen is that when there's a disaster of any kind, the 211 shifts to accommodate what the community's need is at that time. I was in Cedar Rapids last summer working with the flood-impacted victims at the 211 call center there, and it very much became malleable to new resources as they emerged and new information and became the contact point for the community.
Chair Morissette, I also... we are working closely with OEM because of their interest in 211 to be used with 911. Part of the issue is that in states where 211 is statewide and fully functional, when an emergency occurs, 211 can really have an impact. But if it's not there to begin with, it becomes very difficult to set it up in an emergency situation. And it's something that we are looking at as well.
Okay.
We'll talk a little bit more about that in the later slide.
We had a joint committee last year on emergency management that I believe Senator Virgil was a co-chair of, and we heard from Ken Murphy quite a bit, and we talked about 911, reverse 911, interoperability of all communication systems and so on. This time we simply have ignored all of that. This session, we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess the emergency is over, right?
Well, I'll tell you, Ken Murphy would love to have a fully functioning 211. He believes it would have a tremendous impact on the use of 911 during normal times and during emergencies.
Yeah.
So
okay.
He's very interested.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, I want to be able to have you finish the slides, but given the recent conversation, is it true, my experience with our 211 locally is that it usually takes somebody to take the lead, such as Partnership to End Poverty is the one that took the lead on our area and just, you know, basically worked with the United Way to get some additional funding for the program. But it's, you know, it really takes somebody in mm-hmm. these various communities to, you know, step up to the plate and take the lead and and get it established. You know, it's not really your job to be doing that. Is that correct?
Thank you. And I think it's a little bit of both. As the director of the Portland-based, Portland-specific service initially, we came to recognize that there was not, it wasn't appropriate for us to come and ask you for support until the whole state could have 211 service. So I think that we in the Portland office have certainly seen the need and the value. So we do some outreach. I was doing a presentation for the Oregon SafeNet line in Klamath Falls last October and took the opportunity to visit with the Director of Emergency Management there. It was the first time he'd had any information about it. Those kinds of connections are happening. The Director of the Commission on Children and Families in Yamhill County contacted us about 5 months ago and said, we want to bring 211 here. Like in Central Oregon, they've done that local development. They've secured funding from the Commission, from the United Way of Mid-Willamette Valley, and have sought some from Oregon Community Foundation. And we will, looks like, be starting 211 service in Yamhill County the 1st of May. So it very, very much has been grassroots, not sustainable in that way. Mm-hmm. So we're working very hard to secure the federal funding that can carry us, we hope, through the next several years to allow Oregon to put the pieces together at the state level. We recognize this is not the year to ask for money from the state, and we aren't really doing that. But we do want you to know that we're going to continue working on this, where we can bring it up live in local communities, where there is that grassroots effort. We're all over that.
The important point that Jerry made is sustainability. We're fearful of getting counties up and running and then having to turn the 211 service off. And indeed, that's what Washington, to some extent, is looking at right now. The state of Washington has been funding 211, and they're looking at cutbacks in Washington that could impact 211 to the point of counties saying, we're going to turn 211 service off, even though we had it. So it's a sustainability issue. We believe we can help counties get something up and running, but to sustain it over time is going to really, we would have to have some kind of government support at probably both the federal and state level. And I think we're further along on the federal level than we've been in years.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you.
So this next slide illustrates the type of calls currently received by 211. My daughter is sick and we don't have insurance. My elderly neighbor acts very confused. I just lost my job. Can I get food stamps? My landlord won't fix my broken stairs. I just got a job, but I need transportation to get there. I can't pay my heat bill, and I got a shut-off notice. Of course, this is just a sample of calls received by 211 Info. But what might be more important to this committee is the reality that over 50% of our state does not currently have 211 service. And in fact, most of rural Oregon has no access to this important health and human services information and referral line. This next slide. Go ahead, Jerry. Sorry.
This is very hard to read. It's very tiny print, and I toyed with trying to pull a few things out, but I really wanted to illustrate the breadth of types of calls that we get from people. These are the needs that callers identified during calendar year 2008 when calling 211 Info. The biggest one you can see at the bottom is the combination of health services, dental services. The one slightly above that, information only, let me just clarify, says basically someone knows that the Salvation Army can provide them a food box, but they don't remember their hours, or they don't remember the phone number. Can I just get the number to the Salvation Army? So we get calls from people who are familiar with getting help, but don't know where to go right now. The next one up, utility assistance, food stamps, rental assistance, housing and housing services. the very top one, I would mention tax preparation. We have become the number that people can call for EITC or for where can I get my taxes done for no cost. It's not the only number out there. Certainly the AARP's program is working extremely well. The Partnership to End Poverty is doing awesome things in Central Oregon with this year. But that is certainly one of those initiatives that 211 gets involved in across the country at this time of the year. We maintain a database of over 4,000 programs that are community services, public agencies, faith-based programs, web-based resources. The handout you have that is called the 211 Call Center Report for 2008 has much more detail on the calls received during the past year by our Community Information Referral Service.
And that handout also has this slide on it, so it's a little easier to read on your handout than it is on the slide. This next slide, we wanted to just tell you a little bit about, and we've talked a little bit about this, but the importance of 211 in a disaster or crisis. The Oregon Office of Emergency Management supports 211 because it has been proven effective in other states during disasters such as terrorist attacks, hurricanes, fires, and floods. When 211 is available and updated regularly, it is cheaper and responds more rapidly than having a program in reserve waiting to turn on when a disaster strikes. After 9/11, over 300 hotlines and helplines were created in New York. Next door in Connecticut, they used 211 because Connecticut had 211 service statewide. Years later, those hotlines in New York have disappeared, but Connecticut 211 continues to take calls from people who are still recovering from that day. Mm. After Hurricane Katrina and Rita, the 211 systems in Louisiana and Texas handled hundreds of thousands of calls with support from trained 211 staff from around the country. In November of 2007, San Diego 211 and six other 211s in Southern California together responded to 130,000 calls in just 5 days. 211 handled calls about shelter and evacuation routes, leaving 911 available to respond to people in life-threatening situations. If 211 had been fully functional in Oregon, the system would have been critical in response to the December-January snowstorms, both this year and last year, and the flooding. Washington State's 211 was activated as part of the state's emergency plan during the storms and their aftermath, and Washington State's 211 had an official presence at the State Emergency Operations Center. That is certainly something that we would like to see happen here, and I know that Ken Murphy would like to see that as well.
We like to say that to our clients, every day is a rainy day, and certainly that's been true with the recent economic crises. Here's a place specifically where 211, under the umbrella of the Oregon SafeNet helpline, has already been able to partner with the Department of Human Services to respond to the increased need for food stamps. Oregon SafeNet, again, is the statewide helpline for maternal and child health, answered by the 211 staff in Portland. Last fall, we began to document an exponential increase in calls from people seeking food stamps. 1 month, it was 116% higher than the same month a year earlier. When we learned the state was going to hire additional food stamp workers, we asked if we might get some assistance to help with our increase. That agreement was reached, and that employee started last month. 211 can be a real-time source of assistance in these settings.
These next two slides are really there to show you how 211 is nationally, to put 211 in perspective as a national growing organization. 211 has been growing nationally and now has a major presence across the country. In fact, about 78% of the U.S. population has at least partial access to 211. Oregon currently serves about 48% of our population, but as we told you earlier, only currently has service in six counties in Oregon. And the reality is that because of lack of funding, many citizens, even in those counties, do not know that 211 exists. Mm-hmm. And current 211 service does not have emergency funds to ramp up their services during disasters or crises. So in Portland during the snowstorm, they were overwhelmed, mm-hmm. and they had no way of really reacting to that. As I said earlier, at the federal level, the Calling for 211 Act has been introduced to fund 211 across the country. And this would include federal support for expansion of 211 in Oregon. Of course, that would require matching public and private funds, which is why our current efforts to secure a public-private partnership here in Oregon for support of 211 is so important. This next slide is a map that shows the prevalence of 211 in our country, and you can see it much better here than on your copy because this is the color version. All the green states here have 100% coverage. That is 26 states and Puerto Rico. But more important for us, it includes Washington, Idaho, and Utah. California and Nevada are 80% covered, as are a total of 7 more states. Oregon sits there as an orange state with about 48% coverage. As I said previously, that is 6 counties. But even there, we lack the funding to truly market this wonderful service and respond to additional calls during a disaster. 211 in Portland and now in Central Oregon survives with major support from the United Way and a constantly shifting flow of funds from local government sources and private funds. And some of that funding is currently threatened because of our current economic and fiscal crisis in our state and in the country. So we're looking at not only growing 211, but just surviving the current economic crisis.
This is a map that describes what we've mentioned earlier in terms of coverage or interest or development in the state of Oregon at this time. The counties that are marked with green stars are the counties where 211 service is live and functioning Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. At the at its final development, 211 is intended to be a 24-hour-a-day service. So with those 6 counties, we do have coverage weekdays from 8 to 8. In the counties with red stars, we have what I define as active planning and development. At Yamhill, Lane, and Douglas, when I showed this to our partner in Douglas County, he very quickly said, "Oh, and Coos and Curry County is very interested too." So I haven't got those stars on there yet, but clearly that conversation has been happening as well. You can see that there are a number of counties on the eastern side of the state that we haven't had the capacity to connect with yet. That's I think exciting. If we had looked at this map a year ago, most of those stars would not have been there. The development, the interest at the local community level has been highly significant the past year. It feels like this is the time for 211 in the minds of people at the community levels.
That's interesting. And Homeland Security money, is that part of your funding?
We are actually looking, Chair Morissette, we are looking into that, and we've been working with OEM.
Yeah.
There are a few states that have gotten Homeland Security money. It's not easy to get, yeah. And we are actually working on the possibility of getting that. We have to go through a county system in order to get it. In other words, the money comes to the county. It cannot come directly to us.
Okay.
But it is something we are looking at. Part of the problem with the Homeland Security money is that, again, it's not necessarily sustainable. In other words, we might get Homeland Security funding for a couple of years, but then they would expect you to somehow find the funding to continue it after that. But we're certainly looking at that as a possibility. There are some states that have had some success.
Yeah. Senator Bridger.
Yes, you've mentioned the economic crisis several times during your presentation, when actually we've really only been dealing with the crisis here at the state level for about 90 days. So things changed considerably for us from November to March. In other words, I'm wondering if you are a bellwether, though, because you gave some statistics of a fall in the fall a month earlier, much earlier,
mm-hmm.
which in looking back, a lot of the economists are saying we've actually been in this decline for longer
yeah.
than we've been dealing with it here at the state. Can you tell me if your calls started increasing considerably in the early fall, and then what has happened in the last 90 days?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The calls did start increasing in September. I think that was the first month we became aware. Let me back up. We were getting increased food stamp calls in August. That was the first time we noticed a significant increase, and then they continued to escalate significantly through September, October, November. November was an all-time high for us. The last, I'd say, 60 to 90 days, we have plateaued somewhat. I think that we have plateaued at that new high, where we're certainly higher than we have been. One of the other dynamics that we're seeing is that more of the callers have complex needs. In other words, they're not just asking for food, but they're asking for a breadth of services. Not only do I need food, but I don't think I can pay my rent this month, and my child has a cold, and we don't have insurance, and I need to see a doctor. Multiple kinds of needs like that. We're definitely getting an increase in calls from the newly needy, people who have never called us before. And so I think your term bellwether is right on the mark. It's an opportunity that 211 has to play that role of reporter or bellwether that we haven't fully expanded yet and we haven't developed, but it's definitely there.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair. I actually think if you had the ability to do some tracking, you may be able to show trends that would be extremely helpful to people like me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I definitely agree. We do keep a contact record on every single one of our calls. We gather basic demographic information about each one. The first question we ask our callers is, what's your zip code? That helps us search, but then we can also run our reports on that as well and find out where those pockets of need are growing.
And I think if we had a statewide system, you would find that the information that we could gather statewide could have a tremendous impact on the ability of the legislature to make decisions
yeah.
in certain areas, and would also be a bellwether for things that are happening.
How are your calls routed? If someone from Lane County calls, where does their call go to a Lane County person, or is it routed?
At this time, the plan will be that there will be one call center, and that will be the one in Portland.
Okay.
Initially, we had plans for multiple call centers, and in the last couple of years, we've looked at the economics of that and felt like, and across the state, people have agreed that this is going to be the most efficient way to do that.
How can you possibly handle all that information from one call center? What's the phone number of St. Vincent de Paul in
Roseburg?
That's why we have a database. We do look at developing and increasing the relationships with the existing partners who are collecting that data already. Certainly the Lane County database is a tool that would be critical. Our database, actually, you can go in and search first by zip code, you can search by target need, and it will take you to the Salvation Army in Lane County with that phone number.
I think Chair Moore said we're not averse to the concept of other call centers. States do it differently. Some states only have one call center. Other states have multiple call centers. It's really an issue of funding
yeah.
more than anything else. If we had the funding to have three call centers, I think we would look at that. So I think in the future, as we grow and as funding becomes available, that's an issue we're going to have to address. But right now, it does make sense to have the one call center for the efficiency of it. So our final slide here is...
Okay. As we said earlier, 911 is core infrastructure for public safety, and 211 is core infrastructure for human services. 211 is essential in normal times, but it is especially important in our current economic situation. Because of the support that we have received from the Oregon Office of Emergency Management and the Department of Human Services, and interest from a number of state committees, such as your Senate Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee, we continue to spread the word about the importance of 2-1-1 to our communities in Oregon.
And we want you to also know that we will continue to seek funds for current 2-1-1 service and are continuing to seek a true public-private partnership to roll out 2-1-1 statewide. As you can see from this report, we are making progress. We have hopes for federal support through the Calling for 2-1-1 Act and our efforts to secure a federal earmark. We look forward to possible state support in the future, and we are actively pursuing private support to fund expansion of 2-1-1 service. And finally, I wanted to let you know that through the efforts of Oregon 2-1-1 and 2-1-1 Info, 2-1-1 could actually be deployed anywhere in Oregon within hours. We have that technical ability. Since 2-1-1 has been declared an approved FEMA partner, reimbursement is available to pay for this service if deployed during a declared emergency or crisis. That is why on the budget page we distributed to you, there is a separate budget of $800,000 for emergency response. We wanted people to know that we'd love to have $4.5 million, but a lesser amount could at least get us to the point of being able to use 2-1-1 in an emergency. We are seeking funding from any and all sources to create a statewide plan so that we would be able to actually utilize 2-1-1 anywhere in the state during an emergency, crisis, or disaster. That would be a major step forward for our state and would lay the groundwork for statewide 2-1-1 service in the future as federal or state funding became available. And Chair Morissette, in answer to your question, if somebody calls 2-1-1 in a county where it doesn't exist, what they get right now is you don't currently have 2-1-1 service, but they are also told to call their
local community action. We have the service turned on to a voicemail message right now, so that if you were to dial 2-1-1, you would get a message that says, I'm sorry, this service is not available in your area. If you need if you need emergency help right now, call 911. If you need social services, contact your local community action.
And in theory, you can call 2-1-1 from any phone system, any cell phone. That's a constant struggle with new companies coming on board that, that Jerry deals with. But in theory, we would like 2-1-1 to be available in any way that you call.
Getting back to the emergency preparedness effort that we made last session, at some point there will be a 9.2 earthquake off the Oregon coast, and it will cause major damage not only on the coast but in the valley. There could be bridges out and so on, and at that point communication would be disrupted, and I don't know if 911, yeah, 2-1-1. Well, and I guess the ham operators would maybe be the only ones who are able to communicate if their towers are still standing, and you know that's another story. But that's why I'm thinking the Homeland Security, Ken Murphy, interoperability of all of these systems working together in a real emergency is going to be important. But what we're doing now is putting in the pieces here and there.
Right. I think it's interesting, though, in Louisiana, as I understand this from Jerry, because I wasn't really involved at that point, New Orleans, the 911 system was completely down. Mm-hmm. People were actually able to call 2-1-1 because there was 2-1-1 outside of New Orleans that was up and running. Yeah. So one of the issues that we're facing in Portland with the call center in Portland is that it's currently in a building that is not earthquake-proof.
No.
And we would love to move it, and one of the things we're looking at is the reality that we should be moving it to a building that would survive an earthquake.
Good idea.
Because obviously that is extremely important.
We also are looking at developing relationships across the border with Washington and their 8 call centers. Their call centers now, if an event happens in one community, the others can back up and support. The calls can simply get rerouted. With one call center in Oregon, we would need to create that relationship with perhaps some services in Washington, and that's definitely on the table.
Good. Yeah, Senator Burge.
You haven't mentioned dealing with any phone companies. Verizon, Quest, what is the other one? Integra, all these big companies. Have you not talked to them?
Oh, boy, have we talked to them. I've spent years in the case of one particular company getting them to make the connections. The Federal Communications Commission, when they set aside 211 for this purpose, mandated that phone companies must provide the service, but it didn't tell them that they had to do it in an efficient manner. So we have contacted each company individually and given them the information they need to do that internal switching. And the major companies that you described, Sprint was another one, were all completed in 2004, 5, and 6. Then we started talking to the more local companies. One of the things when 211 turned on in Deschutes County was that I learned about a company called Bend Broadband. Mm-hmm. Didn't know they were there, and so we scrambled and got them to do the configuring so 211 could be used by their customers. So, yes, it's been a whole different angle that lives outside of human services.
Senator Montes,
I just feel that this is such a great service. In my professional life as a public health nurse, and this was in the 80s and the 90s, I spent so much time, because a lot of our job is referring our patients to social service agencies, I would be making lists for the nurses of all the social service agencies because they were always changing. Some went out of business, new ones came on board. And I think you've relieved a lot, even to providers, whether they're in social services or in the healthcare field. It's a value. So if you're looking for champions, you certainly have one in me.
Thank you.
Yeah, so if you want to do an info commercial.
Oh, and if you're looking for a place to move that's more earthquake safe, I'd be happy to have you join us in Central Oregon. We have 2 other call centers, which I think hire over a couple thousand people right now. We have T-Mobile's call center there and numerous call centers. We'd be happy to have you there since we already have 211.
I love it.
All right. Just worry about the volcano eruptions.
Yeah.
Any other volunteer sites? Well, this has been wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate having the time to explain it.
Yes.
Well, and it's interesting because we haven't seen Ken Murphy around the Capitol for a while. Session, we spent a lot of time talking about the various kinds of emergencies, you know, and you mentioned the storm in northern on the northern coast, and Senator Johnson, the only way she could get through at one point was through a ham radio operator because the phone lines were down and so on.
Yeah.
So we're beginning to feel the effects of changing weather patterns and so on.
And I know I've talked to Senator Johnson because she's a friend from a long time ago, and the one thing she said was, I'm very supportive of 211. Unfortunately, there's no way there's going to be any money this time around.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there are a growing number of legislators that have an understanding that this is a service we need to figure out how to fund at some point.
Yeah. Good. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We will close the information hearing and adjourn.
Okay.